Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson. It's coming to the end of January 2018. I think it's the 24th. Today we're going to do something. It's been floating around for a while, and a lot of my friends have asked me to talk about it. These kind of things where I have to refute an author, I try to avoid. I pretend I'm sick. I mean, I just, you know, this. But in this particular case, the author, he uses a pseudonym, or I think it's a pseudonym, writes with a certain level of authority such that people may mistake his work for fact. And these are always the most dangerous types. Now, the person here is actually a good guy in a lot of other areas. Talking about Emile Durand, who writes on Countercurrents, which of course I write on quite a bit. Emile Durand writes some excellent work. Faustian Civilization, the New Patriarchy, for example, is a great piece. But he's written a bunch of anti-Russian things. And it's, I guess I have to give in. The one we're talking about is called White Nationalist Delusions About Russia. It's an odd title because Vladimir Putin at no point ever in his career ever called himself a white nationalist or national socialist at all. He is very clear that he is a Eurasianist, that he's at war with the New World Order and liberalism in all of its forms. A Eurasianist can't really be a white nationalist, although he could be sympathetic with them. Certainly not a personal attack on Durand, although, you know, my only problem with him at that level is that he's, you know, writing with some authority, and yet spouts really what amounts to, you know, textbook cliches from the major publishers. Stay in your field of expertise, as I want to tell everyone, including myself. Now, the whole conception of Vladimir Putin as his nationalist leader comes from, as you know, me. Back in 2000, I was the first writer in English to speak of Putin as a leader against the New World Order. I was the editor of the Barnes Review at the time, and I was attacked by everyone, including my employer, my employers, including many of those who are now on the Putin bandwagon. Letters came in calling me a KGB spy. And even Putin himself was seen at the time by the right wing as merely a KGB agent, or even a Stalinist. But soon I converted Willis Cardo, Michael Collins Piper, and a bunch of others. They went and converted many others. So the bandwagon that I created was born roughly in 2002 in D.C. It is purely my creation. Because of my influence in the nationalist movement, it began to bleed in there. And somehow, typical of these people, it got mixed up, and before you know it, he is a white nationalist, national socialist. At no point did I say that. At no point did he say that. At no point did anyone at any time say that. But he is, however, a fierce opponent of liberalism and the organization, the only organization that can actually fight it systematically and globally, and that's the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Admiration of Putin comes from the simple fact that he performed a miracle. Russia, as many of you know, almost disappeared by 1996, 1997. The population was plummeting. The military chain of command had fallen apart. The central government had collapsed. Our regional strongmen, private and public, not that there was much of a difference at the time, had taken all power with Western money. And Russia seemed to have been falling apart, which, of course, is something that the West would have loved. The West never fought Bolshevism or Marxism or anything like that. They fought an empire that big. That was the problem with the Soviet Union. It was simply too large. That empire could have been British. They would have fought it at one level or another. And yet, Putin laid the groundwork, but bashed a few heads together because there's simply no other way to do it at the time. But from 2003 to 2013, Russia's GDP went from $430 billion to well over $2 trillion. She went from a third-world backwater to the eighth largest economy in the world. 1993, inflation was 60% a month, and it went up from there. From 1999 to 2006, disposable income doubled, controlling for inflation. And then Putin instituted a flat tax of 13%, and now has the strictest, harshest anti-corruption legislation in the world in place for some time. But most importantly, I think he's reversed Russia's population decline and provides substantial tax breaks for those who have children. The demographic thing has been reversed now about 10 years now. Belarus maybe a little bit longer. Russia is not an energy-dependent economy, contrary to myth. About between 6 to 10% of the economy is based on oil and oil-related products. Exports are heavily dependent on oil, but Russia really is self-sufficient. The Russian economy has done very well when oil prices are low. And this is because it has a strong state sector, a strong religious foundation, and a stronger nationalist ideology, very general nationalist ideology that holds it in place. This is why Russia under Putin is to be admired and emulated. That's why the left hates him. And I don't know what more he can do. He pulled off what very few men have ever pulled off in history. He's taken an absolutely prostrate state, falling to pieces, and in a few years turned it into a major world power. I can think of only two other people, General Chung Hee Park in South Korea, who we talked about in this show, and Adolf Hitler after World War I, who even come close to this. In the case of Hitler and Putin, it's been done under sanctions from the West. Now, Duran's article doesn't have a single citation, so let's take his word for it. The author is, as I say, good in many other things, but he is not a specialist in Russia. Most of my sources will be Russian language. I do want to mention the author has something on the Black Sea Union, and he's claiming that it's his. The Black Sea Union is taken directly from Eurolipa, from maybe 60 years ago, without any attribution. It's an old one, and it's not cited anywhere. He cites Pilsudski as a source of this, but he doesn't mention any book or anything. In his essays, Bad, Good, or Indifferent, have almost no citations of any kind, and that's unacceptable. I'm not taking your word for it. Now, he says a lot of things that are true. He says a lot that's false. Here's a few errors, and maybe I don't want to be so pedantic as just quote and then refute it. That's obnoxious. But his view of Russian history is very establishment, neocon, American textbook, freshman year in college crap. And this is what irritates me. And he's stating this stuff as if, this is revelation to people. A lot of the stuff a specialist will be able to refute right away. Other things are a bit more nuanced. Now, let's be clear. The Muscovite monarchy, not what happened in St. Petersburg. Now, that's a revolutionary break, which this author does not understand. There's a revolutionary break because of simply the personality of Peter the Great, the chaos under his half-sister, and of course a time of troubles before that. Now, he does say that the Kievan connection, that there's the Russian historians claim Kiev as their ancestor, and that's really not all that common. Moscow always claimed Byzantium, or even the Tartars, as their ancestor, not Kiev. Now he does say that really only in modern times has that been the case. Catherine the Great, by the way, who was not a legitimate monarch, who was not Orthodox and not even Russian. She didn't speak Russian, I think, much at all. The claim of some descent from Kiev is not an essential argument of royalist thinking. Gilichevsky tried to systematize Russian history, and he connected it with the Normanist idea, Russian origins, which I reject, and I think most Russians reject. But even if it's the Tsardom, which is Muscovite, or the Empire, which is Petrograd, Kiev as the forebearer is iffy and shaky, both historically and as a simple, you know, it doesn't show up very much. Although I made that error in my first book, The Third Rome. Byzantium, even King David, is far more significant in Moscow than Kiev. In fact, in Ivan the Terrible's letters to Kerensky, he doesn't mention Kiev at all. He does mention Byzantium at least once, and he mentions King David about a billion times. Now, of course, Moscow's claim, the Third Rome, is legitimate because Ivan III married Sophia Palaiologos, and she brought an army of Byzantine scribes and artists and friends to Russia, and they set up their own colony there. And that's when Russia began flying the double-headed eagle, and it became its own civilization. Now, here's the crux of his argument, and it's simply wrong. And it's only been the last maybe 5 years I've realized this. He believes that the Tartars are Asian, that they ruled Russia from a massive invasion in the High Middle Ages, and that they intermixed substantially with the population with no resistance and created a hybrid people that's not European. That's propaganda that comes from the British, largely. And it comes from the British propaganda in the Crimean War, where they painted Russia as the Asiatic horde. Now, I've read both in English and in Russian, now somewhere between 60 and 70 genetic studies proving that's false. You have to explain how a non-white people can invade, get the cooperation of most of the country, and intermix without any resistance or anyone even talking about it. I know the literature in that era firsthand, and I know it extremely well. No one mentioned them even being foreign. Interestingly, they don't even mention them speaking a different language. They never talk about a foreign tongue. They never talk about translators. Nothing. They are Russians. Or they are Slavs sufficient such that they could be understood. It doesn't make any sense. That would make the Tartar invasion completely unique in Russian history. So he says the Slavic population, which had been indigenous, was then interrupted by this influx of Christianized Asiatic nomads. There is no evidence for this. There's no genetic evidence. There's no historical evidence. The Mongols were not Asiatic. Now, in Russia, no one believes this. Unfortunately, it hasn't bled into America yet. Again, this is an error that I made in my first book, The Third Rome. I had to fix it, and I've taken great pains to retract it elsewhere. Now, if you go to the High Middle Ages, pictures of Genghis Khan and his successors, done by contemporaries, show him with white features, with red hair, and with either gray or blue eyes. No contemporary descriptions, and I know them all, of Mongols ever mention that they're Asian or foreign. Tartars are mentioned in the Novgorod Chronicle, but they're described only as godless and pagan, never as Asian or foreign. The Persian historian Rashid Adin, who's a contemporary of Genghis, writes that his children were born mostly with gray eyes and blonde. It's highly unlikely, and I've made this argument elsewhere, but the Eastern nomads were able to consolidate and field an army of at least 500,000. With all requisite supplies in less than a generation, and have all the skilled labor necessary to outfit a massive army like that and create this administrative apparatus as successful as the Mongol was. It doesn't make sense. It can't be done. A few decades before, they're a loosely bound group of nomads with no technology to speak of, and 20 years later, they rule the world. That's not true. It doesn't make sense, and there are no records in Mongolia pointing to this whatsoever. And my favorite piece of evidence, and I've said this before also, I'm going to say it again, the Battle of Kulikovo. The contemporary painting is meant to be a Russian versus Tartar thing. Even though there were Tartars in both forces, but the artist was writing it as Tartar versus Russian. And you can't tell the difference between the two sides. If you look at this picture, you can't tell the difference. But when they depict actual foreigners like Turks, they make it very obvious that this is a foreign group of people. The article called The Tale of Batu's Capture of Ryazan, which is a contemporary, the invasion. The leadership of this southern Russian town had no problem communicating with the Mongols. There is no sign or mention that they're of a different race whatsoever. Another one, the contemporary painting, the Capture of Moscow by Khan Tokhmish, 1382. Both sides appear identical. There is no difference between either one. There is no way to tell who's a Mongol, who's a Slav. That's because the Mongols were not Asian. There is not a single contemporary document showing that an Asian group of nomads took over Russia. After 300 years of an occupation, not a scrap of paper. There's references to Tartars, but never Asians. Now, the name of Russia was Great Tartary on all maps of the era. Duran notes this, but doesn't understand the implications of it. The Mongols first invaded in the wintertime, using the ice as a bridge over rivers. Or this is what the official history say. Now tell me how a minimum, and if you have an army, at least 500,000, with each Mongol warrior having 3 horses, that's 500,000 times 3. How were they supplied? Now the old Russian sources say 500,000, even if it was 100,000. You have to account for 300,000 horses, at a minimum. And this is beyond the Mongol capacities, the actual Mongolian capacity in the best of times. But in the winter, in hostile territory, the Mongol capital of Karakum have turned up no evidence of any occupation of Russia. And then the Russian capital, the Mongol Empire, Sarai, has been dug up many times, and only the most primitive utensils have ever been discovered. There is nothing there. And the earliest chronicles show Tartar Mongols, as they call them, speaking Russian. That includes the very first invasion of the Horde. And the title of the Tartar monarch is Tsar. In the earliest chronicles. Letters from Poland and the Vatican talking about this, never mentioned. They never mentioned that they're foreign. They never mentioned any kind of foreign occupation or that Asians have taken over this Christian area. Nothing of the kind. And it bugs me that for a long time I bought the story. It doesn't make sense. In fact, one of my very earliest podcasts, The Voice of Reason, which is in my archives, makes this error. On the Mongols. But now, scientifically speaking, the Laboratory of Population Genetics, which is the Human Medical Genetic Research Center of the Russian Academy of Sciences, completed a massive, massive study of Russia and the Volga Tartar. Oleg Baranovsky was the main scientist, or about 100, and the conclusions were published in 2013. This was the largest, most comprehensive genetic study of the Eastern Slavs ever performed. First thing that they know, note, is that Russians are genetically identical to Ukrainians and Belarusians. The new issue, the real revolutionary concept, is that the Tartars of the Lower Volga, Baranovsky said that regarding the Russians, we could say for sure that the Mongol conquest of the 13th century, contrary to popular belief, had no effect on the gene pool. And that's what he said. The Mongol Empire existed, it just never took Russia. So this fact, which is now at this stage irrefutable, has destroyed Duran's argument entirely. I understand the argument that I'm making is radical, but there's nothing I can do about it. We've all made this error. I made this error. There's an article on my website, rustjournal.org, talking about it. The Mongols were not Asian. They couldn't be. I have scoured the chronicles. I've scoured the letters, the lives of the saints and everything else. They never mention these guys as foreign or Asian or looking different or sounding different. They were Russian. They were called pagans. They were called animals. They were called, you know, violent, but never foreign, never Asian, never weird, never had to be strange. Eyefold or anything like that. They say nothing of the kind. Of a much later development. The propaganda used there, though, was to paint, in the 19th centuries, to paint Russia as non-European. And this was the classic British and much later German understanding of it. There is not a shred of truth to it. But, you know, even if you could show that the Mongols were Asian, that Genghis Khan actually pulled this off and he was of Asiatic background, no historian, and I've read them all, no historian says that the Mongols occupied Russia directly. They ruled through intermediaries. The closest they ever came was Sadai in the far south. The only time they would ever cause any trouble is if their taxes were late or something like that, they would invade the country. Even there, usually Moscow, who did the dirty work for them, and did the deeds themselves, and then delivered the cash to South Russia, which is in and of itself a very weird thing. It shows that any kind of intermixing was impossible, number one. Number two, it would make Russia the only country in the world that had this pretty radical racial intermixing with no one mentioning it, talking about it. But also, number three, Russians don't do well with foreign invasion, except for this one. You know, they burnt down their entire country for Hitler and Napoleon. But not these guys. They let them in, and they're doing their dirty work for them. The Mongols not only let the church exist, but subsidized the church. It was actually a golden age for it. So you simply can't make the argument that Russians are Asian. You simply can't do it. There is no Tartar blood in them, there is no Asian blood in them. Tartars and Mongols weren't. A Mongol isn't someone from Mongolia, you put it like that. The way that the Russians used Mongol, the way it's been translated as Mongol, it's from the Greek megalo, meaning great or extraordinary, megalomania. And it's been translated as Mongol. These errors have been made in Western literature before. I think I mentioned I was reading about New York Times articles on the Russian Revolution. And I was a professor at Mount St. Mary's, and Bob, the late Bob Callis, who was chair at the time, came to me and said, "Will you tell me what this means?" And he's reading this, and it refers to Apaches as the Tsar's enforcers. I had never seen this before. I had read some of this stuff before. I guess I never, I just skimmed over it, you know. Or maybe I just didn't want to deal with it at the time. Apaches? What the hell could they be talking about? Well, it took me about an hour. Wait a minute. They're referring to Cossacks. They're referring to Cossacks because Cossacks wear a topknot. They shave their head and they have this long braid coming out of one spot of it. The colorful dress, the headgear, stuff like that. An ignorant person could, well, they don't know who else to compare it to. The Indian, I guess, is as close as they can get. So that's another example of an error like this, that the great ones, the megalo people, are translated into English by ignorant people as Mongols. That's what it sounded like to them. It had nothing to do with a racial or ethnic categorization. And it still doesn't answer the question, how in the hell did they communicate? How many native Russians spoke this language? They never heard of these people before, and vice versa. If they're communicating with no problem, they're signing treaties, economic things, doing all this, you know, real estate deals and all this stuff, you know, like they've been speaking this language for a long time, and they had never heard of each other before. Nothing makes sense. Not a single aspect of this story makes sense. And so Duran's argument is gone for that reason. And it's an argument that I've made. A lot of people have made this, what we're taught in college and grad school. For some reason, while no one believes it in Russia, not one person, not one textbook in any school believes that the Asians took over Russia for 200 years, directly or indirectly. It hasn't bled into America, and the reason is because it would affect that propaganda. It would change people's view. I think one of the things that, you know, Americans distrust Russians, I guess, from the Cold War on an ethnic basis, that they're just different. We don't know who they are. We don't understand. I've said many times on this show during Woodrow Wilson's administration, really right up to very recently, no one in the U.S. government knew a damn thing about Russian history, Russian economics, and they certainly didn't know anything about what a Bolshevik was. In America, you could not major in Russian history at any university. You could take the Russian language only at a couple of, I know it's at Harvard, there's a history program there, but otherwise, you get people who knew about China and Japan and Siam and parts of Africa, Latin America, and yet there's this big black hole, this Tartary, that no one knew a damn thing about. That was the case right up to the 1960s. Only this rivalry between two large empires. A rivalry of sorts. Did you have any desire to get to understand them? And that failed, because frankly, the American English language history is still based on British 19th century propaganda on the one hand, and Menshevik's on the other. And part of my mission is change that. Unfortunately, Durand is not helping. So, whether it be from a historical point of view or a scientific point of view, Russians are identical to Central Europeans, Western Slavs. They're essentially one group. That doesn't argue that they should all be one empire. There's other things other than ethnicity. There's, you know, Ukraine has a completely different historical background, a completely different set of influences. Moscow did not include most of what we would call Ukraine today. Now, he says that under Ivan IV, the Kazan and Astrakhan Khanates were conquered and incorporated into the Tsardom of Russia. The Volga Bulgars populating these areas, falsely called Tartars, were forced to adopt Christianity and Slavic names. And finally, in beginning with the conquest of Siberia in the 17th century, with a gradual Christianization and Russification of mostly Turkic peoples populating those areas. Yeah, sort of. They were incorporated into Russia in the same sense that India was incorporated into London. There is very, very few examples of Russification or forced conversion. The Russian Empire was very different from the British or the Dutch in that they cared only about security. They needed a docile ruling class. They didn't care what they worshipped. If they were, you know, some of these foreign regulars were the most loyal. The Germans in the Volga, the Crimeans today, all over the place. They are, and it's because Russia has provided them over the centuries with protection against Islamic fanatics, whether Islamic or not. You know, like the Iranians, they have no time for these Sunni movements. Now remember, the local Bulgar is a group of people that few people know anything about. They were used by the Middle Ages, they were used by Western powers for slave raiding into Russian territory. Now the problem that we have here, the old common British propaganda is that Ivan IV or Ivan the Terrible destroyed these civilized Khanates in Central Asia. Problem is, if there was going to be trade in Russia and Central Asia, these Khanates had to go. They were in bed with Western powers, and especially in the so-called Bulgars of the lower Volga had been slave raiding into Russian territory for a very long time. They were allied with the Khazars, and in fact, there are some who argue that the Volga Bulgars essentially are heavily mixed with the initial once Khazaria was dispersed. Once these places were conquered, nothing changed in terms of the population. In fact, they were far better. I mean, you know, they gave their loyalty to Moscow because Moscow left them alone. There are very, very few. I mean, I know the Russian language and the Ukrainian language. There are very few Mongol words there. There's a handful. And the handful that exist are contested. Now, he says something else that comes straight out of a typical textbook, and it's about Novgorod. I thought I had put this to rest a long time ago. This is not an error I've made in the past. Now, he makes the argument, it's very common, that the Slavic Nordic population of Novgorod was unaffected by the Mongol invasion, which is true. The swampy nature of their horses couldn't get up there. They were still under heavy Tatar influence. They had to pay taxes, but direct rule was impossible. Direct rule wasn't the case anyway, but Novgorod was relatively isolated because of the swamps and the harsh climate. The notion that Novgorod represented this pure Slavic mentality is nonsense. That it represented somehow this extension of Kievan Rus is equally nonsense. There is no racial difference between Novgorod and Moscow, or Kazan for that matter. There is none. This has nothing to do with race at all. In fact, the overwhelming majority of the population of Novgorod was very pro-Russian, because Novgorod was a oligarchy, and it was a slave trading state. Now he also brings up the old saw that 1478, the population of Novgorod, elite population of Novgorod were slaughtered and all this crap. It didn't happen. It didn't happen. And essentially what he does in this section of his article, he just cuts and pastes any old establishment, you know, Jeffrey Hoskins or someone like that, and claims that it's his. Not citing it, he's claiming it's his. Novgorod was no more or less Russian than any other place. There was nothing Republican or Democratic about it. It was an oligarchy. Specialists will know that excavations of the so-called democratic house held at most 30 people. There's nothing popular about it. It was a slave-owning state, and the Judaizing heresy came from Novgorod. And it came through there from the Hanseatic League because of its wealth. And Marfa Borecki was going to make Novgorod a part of Poland to protect her wealth. They were planning on converting. And this is what eventually provoked the invasions of both Ivan III and Ivan IV. And I've proven elsewhere over and over again that the Moscow invasion and deposition of that oligarchy was extremely popular. There is a tremendous amount of literature written at the time in both places, which I've read until it's coming out of my pores, and there is not a single reference to any racial, ethnic, or religious distinction between the two places. It's all Russia. The big difference between the two areas was that Novgorod could not function really. It's true, actually, most of its wealth did come from agriculture, contrary to popular belief. Trade was a big part of it. But when I say agriculture, I'm talking about furs and hunting and fishing. The salty swamps surrounding Novgorod meant that its destiny is going to be very different. Its remote location and its very, very close proximity to Scandinavia and Northern Europe already show it's going to be a different place. But in the polemics and the writings of the day at the time, no one mentions any racial distinction, or linguistic distinction, or any distinction at all, except their geographic location. In essence, the incorporation of Novgorod into Moscow was a means of protecting Russia's western border from incursions of Poles and Swedes and others. Not to mention, it was meant to protect Moscow from the mercantile ideology of the Hanseatic League. It was popular. Outside of the war itself, there was no large-scale killing of the population. In fact, so many of the elites eventually were absorbed into the Muscovite ruling class. If you go through, as I've done many times, the family tree of the Muscovite boyars, many are from the Novgorod area. And actually, a huge portion are from the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, which was heavily Russian at the time. So Novgorod can't be used. So you have the two big initial planks in its argument, which are absolutely untenable. The notion that the Tartars were Asians, the notion that even if they were, that they mixed with no problem in the Russian population, so they're half Asian, whatever it is, and that this Novgorod, Great Novgorod Republic, Republic of Saint Sophia, as it was known, was racially and linguistically different from the rest of Russia because it was isolated. More or less from the occupation, foreign occupation. you know, they had day-to-day interaction with Swedes and Germans. But that didn't affect anything. They remained Russian and Orthodox. So clearly, they were nationalists in that sense. But those two props in his argument are not tenable. And these things are common errors. But this is what happens when non-specialists deal with extremely complicated topics. This is something that you know, guys like me spend, you know, decades on to try to get clear. And it's not something that you can go read, you know, five or six of the major works in Russian history and start talking about. You just can't do it. Generally speaking, the Muscovite, you know, the archetypal Muscovite ruler, Ivan III, saw Byzantium overwhelmingly as his source. Prior to that, it was, of course, King David as the foundation. King David, of course, political theory of Samuel. Ivan the Terrible saw King David as someone who he was trying to emulate as much as humanly possible. Now, he mentioned something that's sort of half right and half wrong, that ethnic terms weren't used nearly as much as religious ones. That's already anachronistic, and I've made this error before many, many years ago. The distinctions between race, ethnicity, language, and religion were very, very thin and foggy at the time. Only in the 20th century do you have this academic, you know, dividing everything into departments and specialties. And so these are different things with different methodologies and different... No, it wasn't seen that way. These words were used interchangeably. In the polemics against the Poles and the Uniates in 17th century Ukraine, to be Ukrainian was to be Orthodox. To be Polish was to be Roman Catholic. So if you were Ukrainian Orthodox and you converted to Catholicism, you became a Pole. That was extremely important. I mean, it was done. It was said that way all the time. And there's a truth to it, because then you were then plugged into the culture of the Polish and Jewish oligarchy who ran the place. Now, he is right to say that you know, their religious identity is what separated them from everyone else. Every other Orthodox power was under the Turks. Ukraine was slowly suffering with the Uniates. The Orthodoxy was barely hanging on there, thanks to St. Peter Molina and other people like that. It was able to maintain itself. The Patriarch of Constantinople was absolutely, you know, that they had no canonical regularity there at all. They were controlled by the Turks. And as I've said many times on this show, you know, the canonical structure of Orthodoxy in the Balkans had totally collapsed. One of the reasons that the Uniates rose to prominence in Ukraine and 1595 infamous Treaty of Brest was that the Patriarch of Constantinople had simply collapsed, and that you people like Cyril Lucaris, who had converted to Lutheranism while still remaining Patriarch of Constantinople, they were not interested or willing in helping Orthodoxy at all. They, other than the Imperial University, they did not have any education. They were almost deliberately creating an ignorant population. So the nationalist movements in Slav, Bulgaria, Serbia, and Ukraine simply wanted them out. But in this environment, you know, you're looking at a Roman see that's very wealthy and powerful and prestigious, and Constantinople, that's really a footnote to the Jewish and Greek banking empires in the Fanar. That's really all it was. And that's actually being very nice about it. And this is why the Uniates took over. By the way, I was a Uniate for many years. I was married by them. And it's part of the reason why I have some sympathy for the Ukrainian nationalist point of view. I was just discussing this today with a friend of mine, a radio show coming out soon, that Nikolai Gogol's view, which is my view, is that Russia and Ukraine are two different cultures and languages. Very, very different. When we all know, we walk into a Ukrainian Orthodox church, and then we walk into a Russian one, we know which is which. We know, even before we go in the door, which is which. You walk in, and everything is different. Sometimes the difference just has to be felt rather than, you know, comes from experience. It's clearly two different mentalities, two different views. I know reading both languages, and, you know, you have really only about a 30-35% overlap. The Pereyaslav Treaty with Khmelnytsky required translators on both sides. Cossacks always needed translators to deal with St. Petersburg. He says that then from the start, Russian identity was not of a white European people, but of a white Asiatic and mixed race population professing Orthodox Christianity and ruled from Moscow. It isn't true. Russia was a Slavic nation of mixed background, that is true, although not Asiatic, both Slavic and Finnic. Mongols, as I say, were not Asiatic. I was recently reading the poetry of Saint Setapan of Vladimir, and he wrote the brutal Sermon on the Merciless Heathen, which is his description of the Mongols and how Russian sins brought them on. And all of his descriptions, and all of his, whether it be invective or whatever, never mentions distinctions in race or appearance. None of them. And there's, you know, he went out of his way to describe what these people were. But there were Aryan tribes, Kedovichi, the Ilan Slavs, the Radimichi, the Vajri, Severians. These were the tribes that eventually became the Great Russians. Really doesn't matter because all three are very closely related, Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus. There is no difference between those three groups. And the two, you know, Northern and Southern Russian, have very little distinction. Russians in Northern Russia share genetic similarities with the Uralic peoples who lived in North Central European Russia. But there are thousands of others. Mitochondrial DNA variability in Russians and Ukrainians. Implications, the origin of Eastern Slavs. Maliarchuk, B.A. Maliarchuk from the Institute of Biological Problems in the North. Another huge study. And he makes, let me read this at length here. Well, not the whole thing, but let me read a piece of it here. I wanted to investigate the origin of the Eastern Slavs. DNA sequence variations is examined in Russians and Ukrainians by hypervariable segment 1, HVS1. A restriction analysis of the haplogroup specific sites. No significant differences were found for Russians and Ukrainians when compared to other Europeans. In fact, they fall within the range of gene diversity seen throughout Europe and exhibit the unimodal pattern of pairwise sequence differences. Then he says, despite the small genetic distances between Europeans, phylogenetic analysis reveals a considerable heterogeneity of Eastern Slavic populations. They do not cluster together on one phylogenetic tree. Analysis of distribution of rare HVS1 types shared between populations of Eastern Slavs and other West Eurasians have shown that Russians share haplotypes with Germans and Finns. So haplogroup H1 sequence types, which are defined by different combinations of nucleotides, etc., they are found predominantly in common between Russians and German-speaking population. The data obtained allow us to conclude that the Slavonic migrations in the early Middle Ages, from the reputative homeland in Central Europe to the west to the east of Europe, were accompanied mostly by the same DNA types characteristic of the pre-Slavonic populations of Eastern Europe. And, you know, just those two studies that I've cited here, these are massive, they're meta-studies. They're you know, well-funded, very comprehensive studies. It's over. Russia was never occupied by Asians. Russians have no Asian DNA whatsoever, and they share the same DNA as the rest of Europeans, especially Northern Europeans. Now, in Russia, in Europe, this has been the consensus for a very long time. Russians are European in the racial sense. They never mixed with the Mongol element to the extent that there was any Asians involved in their life at the time at all. The article, The History of Slavs Inferred from Complete Mitochondrial Genome Sequences by Marta Sikorska, come to the exact same conclusion. Hundreds of others can be cited here. Duran needs to alter his views here. It would be dishonest if he maintains his views here. He has to change them. There's simply too much scientific work. I'm no geneticist, but I can read English, And, well, actually, these were in Russian. I could read Russian. And it's very, very clear. And it's quite revolutionary. The only places that don't accept this, culturally speaking, are Great Britain and the United States. I don't know if Duran speaks Russian at all or reads it. A lot of this stuff is not readily available for those who don't speak the language. When I learned Russian years ago, I studied Latin and German in college and grad school. High school and college. A new world opened up for me. It was unbelievable what I came across. It confirmed everything. It confirmed what fraud the Western historical world we used to. When you read historians in Russia, even from the Soviet era, you have a completely different universe open to you. The force, the coercion used for historians and scientists in the West is immense. When you get away from that, when you get away from that paradigm, you have completely different approaches and completely different data. The author mentions the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, where the Ruski were identified as such in Western Europe, as if Western Europe is the sine qua non of eugenic identification. Actually, we're descendants of Kievan Rus. Now, let's keep something in mind, and he's kind of right here. Essentially, what he's saying here, their ethnic and linguistic descendants are present-day Ukrainians and Belarusians. Modern Ukrainian and Belarusians developed from the Ruthenian language. All right. Problem is that, genetically speaking, there is no difference. This does not mean that there is not a linguistic distinction or that there is not a cultural distinction. There is. So he's half right. Ukrainian nationalist historians, I have a book, as you know, coming out. I'm quite proud of the biggest book I've ever written on Ukrainian nationalist political theory. And a lot of this, Duran's arguments were not being made by them. Nikolai Gogol would completely reject this. Unfortunately, he never got a chance to publish his history, but his notes are available. In this particular case, that there is truth on both sides. You have a single racial group. There is no genetic evidence otherwise. But your DNA is not the only thing that matters. Being occupied by Poland, and as he says, I mentioned, you know, the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, and a completely different set of laws and ideas and conflicts, got right up into the 19th century. This is significant, and it creates, not to mention the different climate, different natural resources. They're two very different places. Now, who is the rightful heir of Kievan Rus? It doesn't follow from what he argues here. Ukrainian nationalist historians, generally speaking, say that the Cossack host is the descendant of Kievan Rus. A Cossack host of one type or another is who people thought the Mongols were. This was a nomadic, steppe-based Cossack force that ruled Russia, people called the Tartars or the Mongols. That's actually who it was. Not the Cossacks we know today, but a very early version of this. Lev Gumilev also accepted that. There is no racial distinction. Culturally, he needs to argue more about that. Now, Grand Duchy of Lithuania is worthwhile. He doesn't mention anything about it. I don't think he knows much about it. But the GDL was, for a while, the most powerful Russian state in the world. These men viewed themselves completely as Russian and Russian Orthodox. They didn't consider themselves a subgroup. I would say even maybe a slight majority of the major boyar families in Moscow came from the GDL. In the Renaissance, the Treaty of Lublin, one of the most horrific events of all time in the Slavic world, joined both Lithuania and Poland and created this essentially a war where the Russian Orthodox were driven from their homeland in Lithuania and driven into Russia. At least there was somewhere to go. I think the war would have been more violent if they didn't have somewhere to go, and Moscow was quite willing to take them in. Grand Duchy of Lithuania was a Russian Orthodox state. with a powerful Russian Orthodox Church. The great Metropolitan Joseph Soltan is someone who I have notes on him. I haven't gotten anything done yet. Who was a great man. Now, what's significant to note is that they lost this. The Treaty of Lublin meant that they essentially Polonized the area. Russian Orthodox had to flee the GDL and went into the Muscovite service. But let's get something clear. The Polish occupation of Ukraine was anything but a cultural awakening. Ukrainian nationalism came into existence as the Orthodox reaction to Polish serfdom. 90% of the world's Jewish population lived in Poland and served their elite as middlemen so as to keep any monarch from becoming becoming powerful. He makes a common argument. There's a difference. You know, the Muscovites are Slavish and slavish, I should say. And he mentions the Magdeburg Law, which apparently he knows very little about. Slavish civility towards authority is really, it's a stupid comment. It's almost like saying nigger at this point. Slavish civility towards authority. I guess, you know, Duran, please read Pugachev or Razin. Please read about these rebellions. Please read about the massive uprisings that became huge civil wars at the time of Troubles or anything else. And you see what nonsense it is. The old believers are sufficient to show that. It's absolute nonsense. The old believers were at war with the modern Russian state, especially the Petrogradian state. By 1800, old believers were 30 million. So, come on. That's nonsense. That's just name calling. The author also isn't aware of the constant peasant rebellions against Soviet rule. They almost destroyed the USSR. If it wasn't for Western aid to Moscow, right up to the German invasion in 1941. The Civil War in Russia did not end in 1921. If there's one group of people who have a slavish worship of authority, it's Americans. That authority is capital rather than state, but it's still power. The Ukrainian cities were largely occupied by foreigners. Jews, Germans, or Russians. You know, places like Gomel, 30% Jewish. Russia developed its identity because it was an exposed country. Very short growing season. It required a strong state. Ukraine has very fertile soil and has easy access to the major ports of Europe. It doesn't take a genius here. This isn't a racial matter. It's a geographic and economic one. Ukraine and Russia are very different. But it's not because of their DNA, because their DNA is the same. But Magdeburg Law, this is something, this just shows he's just cut and pasting from a textbook. This is not a positive distinction. It's a very common thing to mention in the establishment histories of the era. They never tell you what the Magdeburg Law is, but they say that law, is one of the big legal distinctions between Ukraine and GDL, GDL, I should say, and Moscow. Well, that's true. But understand this. The Magdeburg Law was a legal system from the Hanseatic League where the merchant classes were immune from state interference. It's the creed of English liberalism in the German cities. Essentially, it existed to provide Otto I a solid source of cash income in the Holy Roman Empire. Yeah, it's a mark of distinction, but not a positive one. This was the foundation of the bourgeois mentality. In fact, it was the bourgeois mentality because it was only for those living in the cities. If his point is that Ukraine had a greater Western influence than Eastern Russia, but no one denies that, and that's not particularly interesting. It's kind of a wash as to which these different influences are positive or negative. But let's keep in mind that Ukrainian nationalism exists for one reason, and that was a reaction to the Union. It was a reaction to Polish serfdom, which was the worst, absolutely the worst in the world. Now, here's the last error he makes. I'm not going to spend too much time on it because I'm going to get mad. Listen to this. The recent conflict in Ukraine, referring to 2014, as well as the Orange Revolution in 2004, have to be seen primarily not in terms of geopolitics, as many white nationalists are inclined to do. Most white nationalists don't even think about this topic, my friend. But rather as a deeper confrontation, as a struggle with European Slavs against an alien non-European power. Mr. Duran, shut the hell up. I mean, this is the most historically illiterate thing I've read in a long time, and I read lots of historically illiterate things. There is no racial component here. If you don't know by now, my friend, that the Orange Revolution and its sequel 10 years later was not financed exclusively by Western powers, both capitalist and state, then there's something the matter with you. You're either being dishonest or you just don't know. George Soros has not been shy about admitting this. Neither has Goldman Sachs. I want to know what kind of a nationalist movement has as its primary plank, primary part of its program, to join the EU. This is just, come on. You know, it's one thing to make errors, but something like this is stupid. He's trying to make a racial argument that doesn't exist. And when you start off from a shaky premise, even though it's a very common premise, this is the kind of nonsense that you end up with. This is really, you know, this essentially he's justifying this 2014 rebellion. These are, you know, against Yanukovych. The only thing that these people agreed on was that Ukraine needed to join the EU and NATO and bring the IMF back. This is absolutely nonsensical. These weren't Nazis by any means. You know, Russian nationals need to stop with that. These are mercenaries. Most of the POWs that the Donetsk forces have taken are mercenaries. Most of them are not Ukrainian. There's nothing. The public opinion polls in Ukraine from the Institute of Sociology, this is kind of out of date, probably 2012, show an overwhelmingly positive view of Russia and Ukraine. Now, I've seen this has gone down a bit since the war, of course. But the lowest I found in Ukraine, about a 50% approval rate in Galicia. So even there, which is an old Orthodox region of Ukraine, it's highly westernized, but there's, you know, that's a good thing. That's what part of its history, it's part of its trading background. Overwhelmingly, Ukrainians see Russia in a very positive light. I don't see why they wouldn't. This rebellion, whether 2004 or 2014, was artificially generated. There's legitimate reasons to be upset, of course. Ukraine is a heartbreaking waste of potential. You know, it's something that I think about every day in my life. But this rebellion is to misdirect that. These are foreigners. These are done with a foreign ideology, and only the rebellion only took place in Kiev, and led to the civil war that's, I guess, is kind of just still simmering, where the Ukrainian so-called Ukrainian army dissolved. Many of them deserted to Russia or elsewhere, or Donetsk itself, and morale is zero. Every POW says that no one wants to fight. No one's going to shoot other Ukrainians for an oligarchy. No one's going to die for a handful of what they call themselves New Khazaria in eastern Ukraine, this group of Ukrainian oligarchs who controls this. That's going to be a separate show. They actually call themselves New Khazaria. That's what this was about. Racial distinctions is utter nonsense. Russia has been seen. I mean, when you look at what happened after the fall of the Soviet Union, Ukrainians, Russians, Belarusians, everybody else, you know, that's a Western thing. This is Western ideology imposed on these places, which almost destroyed them. They survived Hitler. They survived Stalin. They survived Napoleon. They survived. They could barely make it through liberalism. The one thing that was going to destroy them was liberalism, not these other forces. And that shows you the corrosive, vicious power of liberalism, because it's based not on state power, but on private power. The belief that Ukraine needs more of that is laughable. No one outside of a handful of Western elites in the cities believe that. But both Ukrainian and American news sources I mean, American news sources are useless on this. This was their big thing. So these nationalists with their flags and embroidered shirts and pictures of Ivan Franko, saying, yes, we need independent Ukraine that's part of the EU and NATO. You know, I mean, this is laughable. It was a perversion of what is otherwise a legitimate Ukrainian nationalist movement. Remember, the Ukrainian Autocephalous Orthodox Church, the real one, the one that comes from Antioch in 1924, consecrated two Russian catacomb groups, Raphael and Vyacheslav, which is under Alexis now. Both of them have Mephodia of the UAOC as their main consecrator. Now, when I say the UAOC, I am not referring to Patriarch Filaret, who is a fraud, who I don't think believes in God, who was a KGB agent for a long time, specializing in subverting the Ukrainian nationalist movement. He didn't get elected Patriarch. A few years ago, he got mad. He went and created the Patriarchate of Kiev. It took over the Patriarchate of Kiev. The UAOC, Mstislav, and Vladimir are legitimate. They come from Gregorius IV, the Antiochian a patriarch who created this so-called Church of Poland, which is 90% Ukrainian, as the Church of an independent Ukraine. I've spoken on this show about Hetman Skodopadze as the model of an independent Ukraine in union with Russia, with the same goals and the same approach, but two independent countries. Skodopadze was overthrown by the Masonic Directorate. So things, as always, are infinitely more complicated than this sort of nonsensical, the errors that Duran makes are understandable. And I sympathize. I've made some of them myself over the years, but to justify 2004, 2014 in Ukraine, in Kiev, on racial grounds, I had to go walk around the block a few times to clear my head of that garbage. But that's what happens when you're not a specialist in the field and you start tackling some very, very deep and involved historical and cultural issues. You can't do it. Emile Durand is an excellent writer. He's done some great work. Stuff he's written on feminism, I read on a pretty regular basis. But when he hits Russia, it all goes down. I've given rock-solid facts. He's going to have to change his opinion on at least some of this stuff. But Vladimir Putin was never a white nationalist. I don't think he's very familiar with the ideology. It doesn't make sense in Russia. Russia's too big for that. Eurasianism, the IMF, I'm sorry, the SCO being at war with the IMF, the non-aligned. This is where Putin is, where he's always been. No one's perfect, of course. I shouldn't even have to say that. But compared to what's happening in the West, the man is beyond extraordinary. I'm not going to say the same for Yanukovych. I have a lengthy article on his political theory on my website. But at least Ukraine was recovering. Now it has no functional economy. It has no functional currency. And the only reason it exists at all as a country is that it serves as a launching pad, an unsinkable aircraft carrier for Western Western military in the event of an invasion of Russia. Duran's mistakes are understandable. We're on the same side. We have to be clear here. But this is something I'm obligated to talk about, because some of the things that he said, they're old myths that I can't believe people are still using them. One thing, in Harvard, you'll hear these myths recycled over and over and over again. We understand that's stupidity. But our people shouldn't be doing that. And there's a lot more to this essay. It's much longer. I have a 17-page refutation of it. I wasn't able to get to the whole thing. I'll publish the rest of it. I've gone over my time here. I haven't been able to get to the whole thing. But Duran really has to change his opinion, at least on a few of these things. And anyway, I've gone over my time. Daron, please stay in your field. You're a good guy when you talk about the other stuff. You know, you're just out of your league here. We need to find out what we're good at, what we focus, and that this is what we do. And please, my friend, learn how to cite sources. I mean, one or two, please. Especially with the Black Sea stuff you're talking about. It comes from Eurolipa. It doesn't come from you. Anyway, we're on the same side. This is not a personal thing at all. There's a good chance we'll be in a gulag cell together. You never know. But these errors cannot remain. And I love the people at Countercurrents. They're friends of mine. They publish my stuff. But this is an error, an historical error. And my job is to correct things like that. Anyway, I've gone way over my time. I apologize for that. Mr. Drawn, thank you for keeping me sharp and having me go back and researching these things. You forced me to uncover the genetic research that I had forgotten about, the Mongol issue. Opponents are just as good as friends. They keep you sharp. Anyway, my friends, thank you for your financial support. I do appreciate that. I said my donors will get a copy of my book on the Soviet Union. Unfinished, but definitely readable. Please assist me in any way you can. The IRS is after me, which is now my newest biggest problem. And I thank you for your support. You guys have been wonderful and generous. And I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.